This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Hello, everyone in the U.S. and around the world. Thanks for joining the show, which interviews baseball's best coaching minds who love the challenge of status quo. First of all, special thanks to our producer, Brian Kroc, and our host, the Lineup Media Group. And I got to tell you, a very special thank you to all our listeners who sent their condolences of my father passing away last week. It was a sad week, but we did rejoice his life. So thank you so much. You don't know how much that meant to me. It was fantastic. So thank you to all the listeners. All right, today we are in the Chicago studios, and boy, do we have a special guest for you. You know him, but if you don't, check him out on the great baseball show called MLB Network and also on MLB.com. If you're outside the U.S. or inside, you can check him out on YouTube. He's all over YouTube, all his shows, and he is a Twitter land person at John Morosi. That's J-O-N Morosi. Check him out. He's on Twitter all the time. He's got some great stuff. He is a graduate of the Harvard University and also a former baseball player there. Started his career at the Boston Globe, broke into baseball as a backup beat writer for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, covering the Mariners, and also Detroit Tigers beat writer for the Detroit Free Press, a writer for Fox Sports, and now a reporter for MLB Network and MLB.com. Listen, this is a man of multi-languages, Spanish, Mandarin, and best of all, Italiano. That's my favorite, as you know, a big advocate of international baseball. I recently met John at the Olympic qualifier in Tokyo, Japan. Let me tell you, what a great individual. Never met him before. Great to be around. Really impressive. That's why I'm so excited to have him on the show. He understands international competition, training. He's been at training aspects, a lot of practices, a lot of games internationally. He understands international competition. So welcome a great Italian-American, JP Morosi. JP, come stai oggi?
Tutto va bene, tutto va bene. È un grande piacere di parlare con lei. Great to speak with you, and certainly keeping you and your family in our prayers as well.
Thank you very much, JP. And I tell you what, maybe we should do this in Italian.
I could probably get you a few minutes in Italian, Peter. I'm not sure if I can get fully fluent during the course of the podcast, but I would do my best. If I flip over to Italian a couple different times, I know that you can offer the translation if need be.
Let's do the English. I have trouble with one language. I think English would be good enough for now. Let's do this, JP, because I know, you know, during this baseball season, man, it's crazy. You're all over social media, MLB Network. There's a lot going on. I really appreciate the time because I know you're so busy, especially at this time of year. But let's do it for our audience because we're going to have people that possibly want to get in the industry, you know, and kind of a little background, how you got in the industry and maybe a little advice on, you know, if somebody was going to get into this type of industry, you know, it's pretty competitive. What are some special things they can do to kind of get noticed?
Well, Peter, it's a great question, and there's no one way to do it. I think that's how I would start. A lot of the advice, I think it may at times sound as though it contradicts itself, but I think in general, because there are multiple paths and ways to get involved in the business, there are different ways to go about it. And one way I would say, if you are a player, and you love the game and you've had a chance to play the game, whether it's at the high school level or if you're in college now or in the minor leagues or even semi-pro independent baseball, whatever it may be, I would always recommend playing the game as long as you can. If you think that you want to be a broadcaster, that's wonderful, but I really do think it's useful to have a lot of playing experience to really accumulate that knowledge that comes through playing. And also the credibility that comes through playing. I mean, players understand, and in my case, I just played at the junior varsity level in college. I played varsity, of course, in high school. But I think even playing a little bit, it conveys the understanding of the game, and I think helps you ask better questions, helps you learn different things by doing. So I'm a big believer in playing the game as long as you can. One of my most important points I'd make, though, Pete, is to learn Spanish. You touched on the fact that I've worked to learn different languages, and I do have fun with it. I love that part of the game and learning different sayings and connecting with people from around the world. But there is a really important practical reason for that, is that right now in the major leagues, about 30%, maybe 35% of players speak Spanish. And that, to me, is a very important way to relate to the people that you're telling stories about, to tell their stories as well as you possibly can. I think it also allows you to simply empathize better, and by that, you become a better storyteller in your own right, because you've heard more about the world and the life experiences of the players that you're covering. So I think that's a really important part of it's been important in my journey. I hope to continue getting better at it in terms of speaking Spanish, but I would advise anybody that wants to get involved in the profession to speak the language. And really, when you think about it too, Pete, you can do those two things I mentioned, both playing the game as long as you can and learning the language. They go together, because if you're able to play the game internationally or even take a training trip to the Dominican Republic, to Mexico, to Cuba, to Puerto Rico, you learn the baseball version of Spanish, which is really what you need to learn. It's not so much what you would learn in the classroom, it's what you learn on the field. And I think having that knowledge of the language is really important. And finally, the other top line point I would make about getting into the business and pathways to doing so is becoming comfortable in multiple media, meaning radio, television, podcasting, as we're doing right here, writing, social media. All of these elements go into the conversation of how you communicate with your listeners, viewers, readers. And the more pathways that you can do it, frankly, the more ways that you can earn income, the more ways that you can make yourself valuable to a company. And so if you think about it, the only thing better than getting paid to watch baseball or talk about baseball is probably getting paid twice, because you speak another language. So if you're doing it for two different networks, one in English, one in Spanish, if you can add a third network and a third language, wonderful. So I think it really just expands your opportunities, because Pete, to your point, a lot of people want to get involved in baseball. Baseball is such a wonderful way to earn a living. So in this competitive field, how do you differentiate yourself? And I believe you differentiate yourself by bringing unique skills to the forefront, including languages and also a comfortability across different media.
Boy, I tell you what great advice for all of us across the industry, whether you're in the, you know, the media, or whether you're a player or a coach or whoever you may be. Boy, make yourself a little different. Be different than others. That's a little bit about what we kind of think about on the show. That's why we call it Thinking Outside the Box. You know, JP, you've been all over the world. You've seen all these teams internationally. You have a passion for international baseball. That's obvious. You know, we talk about Latin players. You brought up, you know, the Spanish language. You know, there's so many Latin players coming from all over, and Cuba hasn't even opened up yet. When it does, you're going to see a great deal of players coming from there. What's your relationship when it comes to looking at Latin players? Why are there so many of them playing in the United States at the major league level, minor league level, some in college? What's the things you see that attribute that to them playing here?
Well, it's such a fascinating conversation, Pete, about culture and sports. And when you look around the world and you sometimes wonder, why does this country adopt a particular sport and become elite at this level and in a particular game? You think about it all the time watching the Olympics, whether it's skiing, whether it's lugeing, whether the Summer Olympics as well, in track and field and every different sport. I think that for different reasons, obviously multiple countries throughout the Caribbean and in South America, when you think about Venezuela and Colombia as well, and Mexico, they all picked up the game at different times and for different reasons, depending on who introduced the game in a particular country. But the reality is that over the last century, in so many of these countries, baseball has become either the national sport or maybe the second biggest national sport. And in countries that love sports and love playing sports as a means of cultural expression, that drives so much interest in that particular game. And certainly, Pete, traveled throughout Latin America, we're lucky to see countries where baseball is the number one unquestioned sport, and how that becomes a dominant cultural phenomenon. People talk about it all the time, the way they watch the game, the way they celebrate the game. It's all unique, and I've loved the chance to visit different places and experience baseball games there. One of my favorite all-time games was in the 2015 Caribbean Series. Cuba was back in it for the first time in a half century, and they played a phenomenal game at Edom B. Thorne Stadium in San Juan against the host country, Puerto Rico. And just the stadium was so loud. It was packed. You could just tell what that game meant. And to your point earlier, Pete, about international baseball, you understand how the game is played different when it's a tournament, when it's an international tournament. The at-bats look different. The urgency on the bases is different. Defense becomes all the more important. And so it's fascinating because we analyze prospects here in the U.S. a lot and break down their tools. Oh, he's an 80 runner, he's an 80 thrower, 80 bat, 80 power, whatever it may be. And those grades are all wonderful. But then you put this player in a tournament and there's 30,000 people screaming and the drums are going and the horns are going and it's a little different all of a sudden. It's not a showcase anymore. It's a real game. And you got to find a way, Pete, as you know, some of the best players in tournaments are those that have a simple approach, who put the ball in play. I think about the incredible walk-off hit from Mexico in the bronze medal game of the Premier 12, Efren Navarro. Efren, I thought, during the tournament, had a phenomenal tournament all throughout with great at-bats, careful, quiet at-bats in big spots, and that is what you need. You do not need to be swinging for the downs on every single at-bat. It's about thoughtful at-bats, great approach, up the middle, moving the runners, and Efren Navarro put his team in the Olympics for the very first time because of that approach. So I think those are the players I always love watching play in those circumstances. It's all about recording outs and making the simple plays on defense. And then, of course, offensively, moving runners, executing with a man on third base and one out, third base and none out. Those are the key spots. And I think the international game, because maybe it isn't quite as inundated with all the data, all the information that you maybe see at the major league level right now, I really love that pure form of the game that you would see watching a Caribbean series, watching a Mexican League game. It's really a beautiful way to play the game, and I've always been very much drawn to that.
Well, you know, I also talk a lot about on the show, and I've been on Twitter, and sometimes I get a little, you know, a few criticisms once in a while, probably because I push it too much, but I talk about Japanese baseball a great deal for a lot of reasons. And they're not perfect, but they do a lot of great things. Talk about your experience, you know, just recently in Tokyo. Talk about your experience with Japanese baseball, your thoughts, why they play so well, you know, how they match up against other international teams. We're talking about a country that doesn't have, everybody thinks they've got, you know, millions of players. I just looked at the recent statistics. There's probably a couple million amateur players in Japan playing totally. And when we talk about the United States, we have 26 million amateur players. We look at other countries that have got a lot more. Talk about the Japanese, talk about culture and the way they do things.
It's really fantastic. And Pete, one of my favorite moments during the Premier 12 was before the gold medal game. I think we were actually talking right before then on the field there at the Tokyo Dome. And as those final 30 minutes or so before the first pitch, there's Team Japan, Samurai Japan, on the field going through infield. True infield, like we all went through when we were 12 years old.
That's
infield,
right.
Okay? Throwing to the bases. The catcher throws it to the bases, inside, outside target, thrown down to second base, ground balls, double plays, infield. And I love that at the moment they were going through infield, the stadium was packed. Maybe 80-90% full. And when they were done with infield, they got a standing ovation. And that to me was perfect. Because it's the appreciation of the subtlety of the game. And even things that are as simple and yet as important as your equipment. And I remember Bob Costas tells a story about interviewing Ichiro Suzuki once and about how Ichiro had talked about the respect that he has for his equipment. That's why he would never, ever throw his bat or his helmet. Why would you, I believe Ichiro told Bob something along these lines, why would a craftsman ever throw his easel onto the ground or his paintbrush? It's not the paintbrush's fault if he made a bad stroke. You have to respect your tools. And it's just such a beautiful way to look at the game as a matter of self-expression, but also an object and a task that can be perfected. and to play the notion of playing perfectly. Of course, we all know that it's impossible to play a perfect game in baseball unless you're, of course, pitching and it's 27 up, 27 down, but perfection is so elusive in this game. And so it's important to just continue, though, to try, to strive for that. And I think that in the Japanese culture of baseball, the striving for perfection and for honing every last bit of fundamental in a game is always present. There's never a level of satisfaction that says, oh, well, I've figured it all out now, I'm good, and I'm going to take the rest of the day off, or I'll take tomorrow off, because there's always a way to work on your craft and get better. So I think that, to me, Pete, is what I experienced there. And certainly just the passion of the fans. There's a robust conversation right now here in the U.S. about pace of play and how we can make the product better. And it's an important conversation to mm-hmm. have, believe me. But I also look at it, and when you travel to Japan, you realize there's more than one way to do this here and to have excitement. Because in Japan, as you well know, the notion of walk-up music and a lot of in-stadium scoreboard-operated entertainment and urging the fans to cheer, there is none of that there. None of it. Mm-hmm. It's all individualized cheers that come from the crowd themselves. And there is no scoreboard needed to tell fans when to cheer. They simply learn the nuances of it through their conversations with their fellow fans. It is similar to the way that the cheers at a Cameron Indoor Stadium for Duke basketball are passed down from one undergraduate to the next, from senior to freshman. It's the same mentality here. And I think it's to those who maybe haven't seen it, I would say if you're watching a college basketball game and you see the Cameron Crazies at Duke or the Izzone at Michigan State, and you think about the fans jumping up and down and cheering and clapping all in unison, well, project that over a 50,000-seat stadium, and that's what you have at the Tokyo Dome when Samurai Japan is playing. It's such a beautiful expression both on the field and off the field. And Pete, to see Japan play that game, of course, in the finals against Korea, a tremendous rivalry in international baseball. For that to be the way the tournament ended was in many ways perfect, and I was certainly privileged to be there and call that game.
Absolutely. Against Korea, what a nemesis. I mean, what a game, full house. That was outstanding. I got to agree with you 100%. You know, through your career watching international baseball, what's kind of surprised you a little bit, whether Japanese baseball or any other country, when it comes to maybe some strategy or something that's happening in the games, and you kind of said, wow, that's interesting?
I think that it's the ability of players who are experienced in winter ball to put the ball in play. That and the fact that you look at the MLB game right now, and it amazes me that we have such an issue at the major league level with adjustments. Now, I realize I'm venturing far outside of where my collegiate junior varsity experience would qualify me to speak, but it does raise the question, and I've observed it myself, so I think I'm free to make the point here. There are players that I see in a Caribbean series, in a Premier 12, that find ways to execute, that play very good defense, that put the ball in play, don't strike out very often, and yet, for whatever reason, now in the current iteration of the power-obsessed game and power hitting and power pitching, that a lot of really good players, who I think are very good complementary players, maybe not stars, maybe not all stars, but solid contributors who would be, you know, maybe your 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th best position player on a club, are not getting a look at the major league level. And I think a lot of these players are really good baseball players. And so I think it's a statement, Pete, of the depth around the world, the number of very good baseball players that exist and are still playing right now. And I just think that for so many players, unfortunately, it's all about where you are in a particular snapshot of time. That a lot of it depends on certainly where you signed, because when a team invests a lot of money in you, there's a lot of belief on the part of the player development folks and the people that drafted you and recommended you or signed you internationally. Oh, my goodness, we have to find a way to get this guy to the big leagues because we all invested a bunch of money in him. And if he doesn't make it, then a lot of questions are going to be asked of us in terms of how we're identifying and developing players. And so I think that, and part of this is life, of course, Pete, where there's luck involved and timing is everything in life, it seems. But I'm always struck by the story of Victor Martinez, who told me, I think he was 17 years old when he signed with the Indians. And he said, I wasn't ready to sign when I was 16. I wasn't working out the right place or wasn't quite good enough yet. And there was the one scout from Cleveland who came through my town when I was 17. And it was a very small signing bonus. I can't recall exactly what it was, Pete, but it was not very big. Mm-hmm. And basically, Victor said, the one guy that came to my town, it was from the Indians. He offered me one contract, and I took it, and I left. And that was it. I knew that was, at 17 years old, that was my last chance. Think about that. A multiple-time All-Star. He was almost considered over the hill. No chance at the age of 17. Wow. And I think we all reflect back on our lives and how – at 17, we're not a finished product. Hey, I'm 37. I'm not a finished product either, okay? So we're also learning something. Mm-hmm. And I just think that the game, and part of it's just the number of people involved in it, the number of sheer number of players that organizations have to work through and sign, and it's never going to be a fully efficient market where the very best 750 players are always active in the major leagues on a given day. It's probably never, ever going to happen. But I think it just expands your understanding of how many quality players are out there, and then you get to a big moment in a postseason game, and very good major league players are striking out all the time, it seems, with a man on third base and one out, or a man on third base and none out, or first and second and we can't get a bunt down. And so that's always what makes me curious. I just watch these games and say, hey, this is a good player. This is a good player who can help this team that I just saw in the major leagues. And I think that's the one issue where, and part of it is certainly outside of the club's control. They can't have a 500-player roster, and there are certainly barriers that exist to signing all the players in the world. I get that based on different player acquisition systems. But it really does expand your understanding, Pete, of how many great players there are in the world and how I believe MLB teams would do well to take those really good complementary players who we see in a Premier 12 setting or a Caribbean Series setting, knowing how to put the ball and play in a big spot. Think about two of the biggest heroes in the last couple of playoffs in MLB. Steve Pierce, World Series MVP, 2018 with the Red Sox. Howie Kendrick, 2019. These are guys that were in some ways the seventh or eighth most important position player on a given roster, and yet they're the biggest heroes in October. Why is that? And how many other players like them are around and playing in tournaments that are not getting the looks and the opportunity? So I think that's why it's so incumbent, Pete, on MLB teams to not give up on players, keep getting multiple looks, and be open-minded to the players who maybe don't necessarily fit what you thought your description was of a quality major league player.
You know, well said, and I really believe that the game is going to kind of come around in a circle where some teams are going to start realizing that, you know, the bunting, the hit and run, the other things that, you know, that we used to do in the game, they'll start doing those because you can win by having players like that that are successful. You know, you take the Japanese, won the World Baseball Classic twice. I remember Ichiro, the first Classic, first inning, a Hall of Famer. First inning, number three hitter, bunting with man on first and second, moving the runners over. That's their game, as you mentioned. Pitching, defense, move the runners over. And I understand the statistics behind, you know, so many guys score from second base, you know, and all that. But at the same time, there's got to be more to the game than just home runs, and that's what we're seeing now. So I'm hoping that changes a little bit. JP, I got to ask you, the international game is a little different. You know it. First of all, I want to give Mexico a shout out because that was my fault. Mexico for qualifying for the Olympics, the very first time ever that they qualified for the Olympics. Congratulations to our friends with the Mexican Baseball Federation. And speaking about the Olympics, we instituted the WBSC, the World Baseball Softball Confederation, and the Beijing Olympics. We instituted the extra inning rule. You know, that is when there's a tie game after, at that time it was 11 innings, now it's after the ninth inning. Tell me about what you think about some of the unique rules of international baseball, like the extra inning rule.
I like it. And to me, Pete, we should look at it more seriously in Major League Baseball in the regular season. I do think that it's, you think about the playoffs and even the circumstance with game three of the World Series in 18 at Dodger Stadium. I think that game is a good example of why in the playoffs, it should be able to be played to completion, similar to overtime in hockey. Regular season hockey, you've got a five-minute overtime period, similar situation where they go 3-on-3. A lot of times now in hockey, games are ending in the run of play in the five-minute overtime because it's 3-on-3. Tremendous excitement. I'm a big hockey fan. I love hockey so much. So there's a lot of flow, and you're seeing more games now with 3-on-3 ending prior to having to go to a shootout. Okay, so the analogous thing is here, let's play it out. Let's have the tiebreaker scenario where you've got the men on first and second, nobody out to begin extra innings during the regular season. Because while the playoffs, I think, should be allowed to be determined on their own, in the regular season, if you have a game that goes 15 innings or 16 innings, what invariably happens is players get sent out from the major league level to the minor leagues to get a fresh arm in there when they have done nothing wrong. In fact, there are sometimes cases where the pitcher who was able to throw four or five scoreless innings in extra innings is the guy who was sent down after the game because he can't pitch for a few days anyway, so you get a fresh arm up there. To me, that is not the way that it should be done. We should not be sending players out because of overall roster fatigue. That results in a situation where you do not have the best 25 or 26 players now in the major leagues at a given time. And that's not what the idea is. The idea is to have the best players in the big leagues all the time. And so regular season, fully on board. It is a better game, I think, for the players to play. You're not stressing pitchers needlessly to go the extra inning all the time and put them at a disadvantage for the rest of the week and maybe the rest of the season. I just think it's a player safety standpoint. It's a competitive integrity standpoint. And if we're going to have a situation where we impose upon the game now the rules about not allowing a position player to pitch, which in principle, I think is a wise decision. We shouldn't have position players pitching. Mm-hmm. But if we're going to engineer the game in that way, then what is the problem with further engineering the game to just bring about a more logical conclusion by having men on first and second, where you avoid a scenario whereby you were having a moment where you'd had the backup catcher throw in the 15th inning. I think I would much rather have the tiebreaker scenario in effect in the 10th inning. The game lasts an hour and a half shorter, and you don't have a catcher out there on the mound in the 15th inning. I just think it's a better overall. It's a cleaner outcome. Will all the purists be happy? Maybe not. But no. I think that it's the fairest way to handle it.
I agree with you. And as we talk about that, the memory goes a little bit. One of my favorite movies, Mr. Baseball, and with Tom Selleck, when he goes over to Japan. And I remember that one scene where the game was tied and the inning, you know, was bottom of the half. And he wanted to go back out on the field. And all of a sudden they told him, no, it's a tie after 15 innings. And, you know, he couldn't believe it was a tie. So, yeah, you're right. Sometimes your purists may not be that. But I think more people are coming on board with some of the changes. Now, Bobby Valentine has talked about, and I've seen him many times even on YouTube, talk about the unwritten rules. You know, there's a lot of unwritten rules in Major League Baseball. But I want to talk about one specific, and we can add any others. You know, one is being that, you know, I remember interviewing eight Olympic managers separately and asking them, you know, when do you stop bunting and running? Now, international, it's a little different because of you need the runs, obviously, with the tiebreaker rules. But when I asked, you know, when do you stop bunting, stealing, run, and all that in certain innings, I got eight different answers. And we've had issues in international baseball sometimes because of that. What's your opinion about the unwritten rules? You know, shouldn't we all be playing by the same rules all the time?
We should. And I think that in baseball, in many ways, Pete, that there are, and this is where it gets kind of interesting. You talk about the tiebreakers and the understanding of, hey, if you have an eight-run game in a tournament, this is why you still have to have a bunt here and why we're still trying to add on to our lead because of a tiebreaker rule that you're trying to maintain and have that as a possible outcome at the end of a tournament. So I think there are some rules specific to the tournament, if you will, where everybody has to have a good understanding of why runs are being added on at particular times. The other part of the equation that I would mention on terms of celebrations and those unwritten rules about what's permissible to do on the field and how to handle those things. I'm a believer that we should allow emotion to exist in the game. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the difficulties I have is we talk a lot about wanting to make the game more fun for young people, more identifiable for young people, more interesting for them. And then at the same token, we are trying to then still stifle the individual expression of players when it comes to celebrating a home run or celebrating a big strikeout. When you look at sports that are incredibly popular among young people, soccer is one, those very elaborate goal celebrations. Basketball, same thing. Football, same thing. Mm-hmm. I just think that we occasionally, in the baseball world, it'd be better for us to speak with one voice. It'd be better for us to say, listen, it's okay to celebrate. It's okay to show your emotion on the field. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think it makes us better as a game because it brings in more young people to the sport. Baseball is, objectively speaking, Pete, the best game you can play. It's the best game you can play because you can play it for the longest. There's a really rich lifelong component to it. If you think about adult softball and from a recreational standpoint, you're able to go to a ballpark and have a conversation and share it with the next generation in a very, very relaxed way. And plus you can have a long career at the major league level that's incredibly lucrative. There's a lot of reasons why baseball can market itself to young people who play multiple sports and say, listen, let me explain to you why baseball is the best option for you. And I think that to me is something baseball could work on, but it's difficult when baseball presents that material and says, hey, listen, you can do anything you want to do in this game and have a great long career and be yourself. But then 3 days later, you've got a pitcher throwing at someone because he flipped his bat when he had a home run. I think that is to me counterproductive. It results in a diminished excitement around the game, and I think baseball can overall do a lot better moving forward of empowering people to make sure that people are not being thrown at for being themselves. That's a really important element of self-expression where I think it's crucial for the game and for the league to make sure that players and young people know this is a sport where you can be yourself and celebrate the great things that you and your teammates do and not be afraid of getting thrown at the next time you come to the plate.
You know what? I got to tell you, I'm so lucky to be in international baseball, and I can't, because it's so much fun. If you were in charge of international baseball, I mean, there's so much excitement, so many changes going on to make it even a better game. If you were in charge of international baseball, what would be some changes you'd make? Would you institute the three-batter rule for relief pitchers? Is there something unique that you would do to make the game better for the fan itself?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think I would go with the extra inning rule for sure. I would adopt. I'm not a huge fan of the three batter minimum. I think that the left on left pitcher has been a part of the game for, I guess, in a really big way the last 30 years or so, and I think that those players are unique and they add their own color and texture to the game. That I think that Arthur Rhodes and Randy Choate and Dan Plesac, those guys, they've really been great for the game and added a lot of strategy. Mike Stanton, think about what he meant to those teams with the Yankees that were winning the World Series. So I'm a believer in keeping that pitcher as part of the game. So I would say, for me, I'm not a fan of the three batter minimum. Mm-hmm. I think that universal DH, I think, is a good idea, as long as you do it as part of a dramatic realignment of the major leagues along geographic boundaries and considerations with very importantly, the understanding that you'd probably expand to 32 teams. If you expand to 32 teams and you've got four divisions of eight, then you can go universal DH, and then you standardize that, and you've got the Mets and Yankees in the same division, Cubs and White Sox in the same division, Angels, Dodgers in the same division. You can get really imaginative that way in a manner that I think promotes a lot of unique regional geographic rivalries. And I think that we can get that way and do that if we get to a league that has 32 teams, standardize the DH. I think that, to me, Pete, is the way to go.
You know, I love the World Baseball Classic. I got to ask you this. I know Bobby Ballantyne had mentioned this one time, and that's why I bring it up. Yeah, he wanted to see a World Series, true World Series between, yes, you know, the winner possibly of Asia or you know, a playoff round, then a winner to have a true World Series. What's your thinking on that?
Would love that. I would love that. I'm glad you brought that up because when, you know, first of all, it is funny, and you have to – whenever you take a step back from our own American prism of things, and we call our champion the World Series, which
right,
you know, I'm sure 100 years ago, certainly it was a bit more of a true statement because we were kind of the only show in town, so to speak, or at least
right,
one of the only shows in town. But now the game has gotten so big, it's played so broadly around the world that we should have another series, a global series, if you will. I think it really would be wonderful. You don't necessarily have to do it every year. And again, mm-hmm, I make the comparison to hockey, which is a good, I think, a useful foil because it's a similar sport in terms of its worldwide reach to what baseball is. And back in the 70s, I believe, early 80s, sometimes you would have all-star teams or all-star games or different series that were not one conference against the other or one league against the other, but actually the Montreal Canadiens played the Soviet national team, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You had some really unique one-off tournaments. There were some really notable, I know, Rendezvous 87 in hockey. They played that, I believe, at the Quebec Colisée in Quebec City, and that, I believe, it was the Soviet national team against the best players from North America. So there was like an all NHL all-star team against the best from the Soviet Union at that point in time. So those types of tournaments and those types of formats, I think, Pete, are very appealing to me. You don't need to have it be an every year thing. And if you're already going to play a series in Japan or in Korea after a season is over, as MLB has done in Japan multiple times, why not just have that series be the World Series champion? So listen, guys, we're going to give you some extra money as part of the whole plan based on the sponsorships and the media rights, and you're going to win Game 7 of the World Series, and then you're going to fly a couple days later, maybe to Dodger Stadium, so that way it's a somewhat of a – or maybe you play a couple games in L.A. and then a bunch of games in Japan as well. However you end up doing it, you find a way to stage, whether it's a one-off thing or an annual thing, but start up with one time – and have a big series to really capture that imagination. And if Americans, frankly, are convinced that they have the best league, then there should not be any trouble in proving it. I mean, if you're the best, then why would you fear anybody? So I think it's and the money, as we know, I think, honestly, Pete, would do quite well. I think that given the amount of interest in the sport around the world, you know, especially in Japan, the sponsorships there, there would be no problem, in my opinion, from a standpoint of putting it on the air and selling the sponsorships. I think it would be a fantastic way to go about things, and I think we would see a lot of growth, I believe, in the game worldwide if we had a true global showdown series of that type.
You know, JP, I wouldn't mind seeing the All-Star game being international against the U.S.
Yes,
players.
I agree. I've said that before, Pete, and I fully agree. I think as well we could maybe get to a point where in the future, I know this has been talked about a little bit in the past, maybe the finals of the WBC would at some point in time take the place of the All-Star game, where you would play the preliminary rounds in March and then in July, semis and final. I think that'd be a great idea. Because the All-Star game that week, Pete, is one of the unique points in the calendar for the sport where baseball is the only game in town, really. There's some golf going on at that time, depending on where the tennis schedule is. But for the most part, it is our time to shine. And if you want to build interest around the international dynamic of the game, there is no better time or place to do it than the All-Star game because you have the attention of the country and certainly the baseball world at that time. So seize the opportunity. I've also said, Pete, even you think about all the great players who are there, even if you want to keep the MLB construct of AL versus NL for Tuesday, fine. Well, on Wednesday, again, assuming you have enough resources to make it worth everybody's while, the networks and the players and everybody, stay behind for a few of the players, play a Team USA against either U.S. against the world, or if you want to take the U.S. against the Dominican national team, the U.S. against Japan, call it an international friendly if you want. It doesn't really matter. Just play the game and see what happens. See what happens. You've got nothing to lose. You've already got all the same players who are already there for the most part. You'd probably bring in a few extra players on the world side depending on how the roster plays out. But it'd be an amazing spectacle. I think back to the atmosphere, Pete, at the in Miami at the World Baseball Classic in 2017. It was electric. And, and that same ballpark hosted the All-Star Game the next year. And my goodness gracious, if you or I think it was even that year, if you had seen that same level of fans, of excitement there, if you brought those same two teams back, if you had a rematch of that incredible, iconic game, U.S. against the Dominican Republic in July, the fans would have been absolutely outrageously enthusiastic. You would have had noise. You would have had excitement. It would have been a tremendous spectacle for the game. And it would have proven just what a great international baseball town Miami truly is.
Absolutely. JP, I know you're also a hockey fan. You covered hockey at Harvard. I wanted to jump to that because I was on a flight recently and I watched the movie about the Russian Five, the defections and all that. What a tremendous movie. Yeah, and I bring that up because I want to get your opinion. You know, I'm hoping Cuba, U.S. settle on some relations here soon because, you know, a lot of Cuban players that try to come over really get taken advantage of. There's a lot of stories out there about it. You know, and I hope that because I think there's a lot more players coming out of Cuba and it'd be nice for them to be able to do it freely. What's your opinion on that as far as the players getting, you know, trying to get over here? It's dangerous. They're being, you know, sometimes being kidnapped. Any stories you know about certain players that you were able to cover that kind of come to mind?
Well, it's harrowing, I think, for those players, Pete. And really, when you think about it, all they are trying to do is pursue their dream to play the game they love at the highest level. And from a humanity standpoint, I think we can all relate to that, just the chance to pursue your dream and to test yourself against the very best. That's just a very natural human desire. And I believe, Pete, there is a way, and certainly it has to now involve multiple governments and multiple leagues, and MLB thought they were on the verge of this within the last year, but it was not allowed to move forward by the Treasury Department at this point in time in the U.S. But I think in general, when you really look at it objectively, there are ways for maybe not everyone to get everything they want, but for people to get, generally speaking, what they want and what their interests are protected in this particular circumstance. Because there are still ways, I think for the Cuban perspective, as you well know, the domestic league is very important, and also the prestige of the national team is very important. And so when we have seen Cuba now struggle to compete at the highest level internationally because so many of their players have left, and also that has resulted in the league itself, the Serie Nacional, being hollowed out of a lot of its talent. Clearly that situation has not served that aspect of the Cuban baseball infrastructure very well, the number of departures so far. So the way I believe to work through it is to have that process of players who are able to leave but then come back and still play in their winter league to strengthen the domestic league and still play for the national team while doing all of this legally. And I think MLB looks at it from a human standpoint and says it's not fair, it's not right for players to have to risk their lives to simply play the game they love. And I think that a lot of people, I think, in the world on this issue have their heart in the right place. I think it's a matter of getting the policy to line up to have the letter of the law agree with that. But I do know that baseball is deeply concerned, as is the union, by the way, to make sure that players do not have to risk their lives to simply get a chance to play in the best league in the world. And I do think that we'll have a time in the future, I'm not sure how soon, but I think that there will come a day when there is more freedom of movement between, and more, we've already seen now where Some Cuban players in MLB have been allowed to go back to the island at different times under different circumstances, but it's not as rigid as it used to be, and that's a really good sign. So I think that there is hope out there in the future. Again, it involves a lot of governmental factors that are difficult to predict. But I do think that from the Cuban perspective, for the Cuban national team to see their prestige go back up again would be incredibly meaningful to the Cuban baseball establishment, to Cuban baseball fans. And I think one of the reasons, Pete, and not to delve too deeply into it, but I think one of the reasons why the last decade has been so difficult for Cuban baseball in terms of its competitiveness relative to the rest of the world is that when players began to leave, then it was no longer just, as you see in Japan or Korea, the best selective maybe one or two or three players in a year who had the chance to be star-level contributors in the U.S. who would come. It was anybody who had the connections or the ability to get out. And when that happened, it really whittled away the number of players playing the game in Cuba at the professional level. Players who maybe are not even really having much of a chance to play in the major leagues, but simply just wanted a change. And I think that is the tough part, where if there's a way to make the playing circumstances better for everybody involved, then perhaps MLB would have the very best Cuban players coming out without necessarily having all the players, or not all the players, of course, but a big number of them departing and having a continued diminishment of the quality of the national team and Serie Nacional.
Agree, and not only that. Now, what's great, folks, is, you know, I don't know if you saw it, but the Cubans almost made the Little League World Series finals. They lost to the very good team of Curacao, and also it's going to be great to see what kind of World Baseball Classic team they're going to have, because just great athletes coming out of Cuba, well-defined as players. They play the game well. They're trained well. So hopefully this all works out, JP. Hey, listen, I know that we're on a little bit of a timeline because you may have to go get on MLB Network soon. Just maybe a couple other things. Just wanted to ask you, when it comes to parents, let's switch the game a little bit here. I want you to talk to our parents a little bit. We have coaches, parents, and players around the world listening to the podcast. Talk to them a little bit about, as far as any advice you have for parents or coaches when it comes to working with young players, anything you can give as inspirational that can kind of give them, because it's a game of failure and the kids are going to fail. And sometimes we don't always, as coaches and parents, we don't always know how to deal with that. What have you seen that kind of works out there to help kids deal with the game when it comes to the failure aspect?
Well, Pete, the oldest of my kids is 7, so I'm going to have to ask you for some advice as well, okay? So this is, we're all talking through this together as a way of supporting each other. First of all, the hardest job in the world is to be a parent. We know that. It's also the best job in the world. And what I would say is this, and I have encountered a lot of players. I've just been really blessed in my life to talk with a lot of really interesting people in baseball, coaches and managers and certainly the players, first and foremost, and their approach to the game and the respect I have for their ability to do something very difficult in front of a lot of people all the time, and knowing that failure is a part of the game. I think that when you talk about failure, it's a really important element, because I think there are players who are very carefully managed throughout their entire amateur career, and I think that the idea should not necessarily be, and again, I'm sort of talking through my own thoughts of what I hope my parenting philosophy continues to be in the years to come. Again, I'll check back with you at intervals to make sure I'm doing this. But the goal is not for the kid, for the player, for the student, whatever the young person is doing, the artist. The goal is not perfection at every step. The goal is not to help your kid be perfect for his 12U travel team or her 12U travel team in baseball or softball or soccer, whatever it may be, hockey. That can't be the goal. The goal has to be, first of all, to learn something meaningful from the experience, and second of all, to acquire the perspective that will prevent the player from being, I think, too mentally tired when it really comes time to perform, which is when they're close to an adult. I think there's a lot of kids who suffer from simply playing too much, and whether that manifests itself in injuries or in maybe just simply getting burned out, it's hard to say. But I do find the players who endure, the players who enjoy long careers, some of them, sure, they specialize from the time they're 5 and 6 years old, and that's wonderful. But a lot of the best kids, a lot of the best athletes played multiple sports growing up. I know that was true for Mike Trout. That was true for Mookie Betts. There are players that were exposed to different sports and had friendships in those sports. And it just, it took their mind off of maybe that one sport that you were supposed to be really good in. I think it's a lot of pressure on a kid to think 12 months a year about how important it is to perform in one single thing. That's a lot for me to think about. I'm supposedly a grown up. So I just think that that balance is important. And Pete, you know what? I mean, we talk to college coaches all the time and agents all the time about different circumstances. And so many of them will say, yeah, I like it for the kid to be well-rounded. I like, if it's a college coach, I like recruiting a multi-sport athlete. I like having someone who didn't just play baseball, who's a very balanced athlete, can do a lot of different things in the field, who could play second base or center field or left field or right field if he had to, as opposed to somebody, a young man who's only done one, who's only pitched his whole life. That's it. That's the only thing he's done. No other sport, no other position. He's been only a pitcher forever. And then maybe he gets injured at 18. Well, then what happens? So I there are many different ways to do it. And certainly, Pete, as we all know, when you find a parent who says he or she has all the answers, it's a pretty good indication that they really don't. So I don't. I'm just talking my way through it too. But I'm just sort of commenting on what I have seen work. And I always also find as well, Pete, just the perspective and just the conversations of players who you can tell have different outlets in their life, sports or academics, whatever it may be, they're always fun for conversation. They've always got something else on their minds besides the game. And if you are deciding as a young player in sports, and especially this one, baseball, if you are deciding if you've had a good day or a bad day based on what your final line score was in the box score, that's a tough way to go about things. It really is, because you're going to have some rough days. You're going to have a rough month, and it's a matter of just kind of grinding through that. And I think that it's really important to find ways to kind of get through that, because baseball, Pete, and you know this, and I talk about this all the time, baseball is the one sport that I certainly have played in my life, and I would add football and basketball into that, and you know, occasionally in my life I'd put on a pair of hockey skates, but for the most part it was football, basketball, and baseball. It's the one sport that you cannot play better by trying harder, and in fact sometimes that's worse for you to do. Golf is probably similar to this a little bit, but mm-hmm. in football, at the end of the day, you know, you go out, it's a contact sport, you can always play physically, and that'll do you good. In hockey, you can do the same thing. In basketball, grab a rebound, box out, play really intense defense. You don't do that in baseball. You can't. So you have to find ways to, I think, settle down your mental process, and I think that you get that by experience, and I think optimally by experiencing other things than simply just the one thing you're doing in baseball.
I'll tell you what, for a guy that's just kind of working through it, man, that was an incredible answer. Folks, that was not scripted. We do not script the show. When John talked about multi-sport athletes, we have talked about this on the show with experts. We are so thrilled that you brought that up, because there's no doubt about it. That's one aspect of dealing with failure, is learning how to play different sports. And you can see, you know, kids from around the world that play different sports that, again, translate to being better players. And John, that was awesome. I love the answer. And I got to tell you, the last thing, and then we'll let you go. I hope to see you in Arizona at the Olympic qualifiers. You know, the U.S. and some other countries, Colombia and others, have to qualify. They didn't qualify. Some of them didn't qualify in Japan. But I got to ask you, for the teams that are qualifying, like the U.S., you know, this is going to be in March. They're in spring training. Love to get your opinion. Benefit, non-benefit, or a little of each?
Well, I think a couple things. There's been some interesting thought about, and I know talking to some of the people that are involved in selecting national teams for this tournament, how you pick your roster. And we'll see if there are some unsigned major league free agents, because, of course, as we know, or as we believe at this point in time, it's going to be likely non-40-man roster players who are eligible. So minor league guys who are not on the 40-man. So there's some understanding that maybe if there are players who are perhaps at the end of their careers, major league free agents who haven't gotten a look yet, maybe they would keep themselves in shape and then play for Team USA in the qualifier. I think that's one option. But I also think there's peril in that, because you need to take the players who are in the best baseball shape right then. Mm-hmm. And part of the challenge is knowing who is going to be a really good contributor, but who is probably going to be at the Double-A level or not one phone call away from the big leagues. Because if you're one phone call away, if you're one injury away, you may not want to leave your camp 3 days before opening day, because you're hoping that you may still find a way to get on the roster. So it's a really unique set of circumstances. The U.S., candidly, Pete, they've got the most of all the players that are in, of all the teams that are in this competition, they've got the biggest population, mm-hmm. the most players to choose from. Yep. In any circumstance in which the top echelon of players of a country are limited, the U.S. really should come out ahead, because they've got more of those players than anybody else. So the U.S. is really in very good shape to qualify. They just have to build, I believe, a team that is conducive to tournament baseball. We talked about this a little bit earlier on at the top of the podcast. The U.S., I think, did not have enough players who understood the international game in the way that, for example, Efren Navarro did. Mm-hmm. Those were some of the best at-bats that we saw in that entire tournament. The U.S., I believe, had probably a more talented roster than what Mexico did. But Mexico was ready to play the style that was required in that particular tournament. And that's all that matters. Who was ready on the day? That's how you got to win the tournament. And Mexico was ready. I think I credit so much Juan Castro, their manager, Cundi Gutierrez, who has been their GM of their national team for a number of different tournaments now and competitions. They've done a very good job of cultivating a strong sense of community, of cohesion among that group. And I think that in many ways, the U.S. should begin this tournament as the favorite. They should win this tournament. But they will only win the tournament if they play the best together. And if they don't, then I would say look to the teams like, for example, the Dominican Republic, who will be able to potentially build maybe from the same winter ball club. If there's a lot of players from Licey or Escogido together that have experience playing on the same unit, it really does a good job when you can have a group that has played the game together in different competitions. Maybe they take a club that was from a lot of the players that had played in the Caribbean series just prior to that. When you do that, when you have players comfortable playing together, I believe you've got a much better chance at success. And that is one spot, Pete, where the U.S. will very likely not have an edge, because their players are going to come from all over the place, maybe with very little experience playing together. The U.S. must overcome that by taking the very best players who are ready at that particular time. Don't worry about the big names. Don't worry about the prospect lists. You want to take the best 28 players you can in that particular circumstance at the end of spring training, who you know are committed to that team. That is going to be the biggest task for Team USA.
Well said, committed to that team. JP, man, I cannot thank you enough. This was outstanding. You gave more time than was supposed to be allotted, and I got to thank you, man. We appreciate being on the show.
Il piacere tutto mio, mio amico. It was a great pleasure. I only regret that we did not speak more Italian, but that can be in the second installment of our podcast conversation, my friend. All in Italian, and send it over to our friends over there in Italy, Mike Piazza and Bill Holmberg. Everybody great working with the federation there for the Italian national team. So we'll send that version over to them here in the weeks to come.
Absolutely. And I got to tell you didn't know this. I had an espresso right before the show just for you.
I love it. Well, you sounded great. It was great for your voice. It was great for everything. I love the conversation, Pete. It was really a great pleasure for me. And thanks for all the great work that you do to grow the game around the world and help the instruction. Because as you know, that's the key thing. We've got athletes all around the world who want to play this great game. But the key thing for them is great coaching and great mentors. They've got to have great coaches, great mentors, and you're doing that. So we thank you for the great work that you do. And certainly, as we talked about before, Pete, keeping your family in our prayers as well.
Thank you, JP. Folks, now you know why JP Morosi, one of the best, the passion he has for international baseball. You can hear it through his voice. That was JP Morosi, MLB Network, MLB.com. Check him out on Twitter, at John Morosi. That's J-O-N. But he's got a lot of people on Twitter. They follow him. Also, a special thank you to Brian Crocker, our producer in the Lineup Media Group. And most important, our listeners. Thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed the show. We look forward to our next show. Have a great coaching day, and I'll see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm. This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.